Welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, this is going to be the second installment of the Restore podcast that I'm going to put here on the Prius Spot Care podcast. So this is a conversation with Mike Donnell, who has had an amazing life, a truly inspirational character, but from the depths of drug use, near suicide attempts, self-harming, alcoholism and tattoos and steroid abuse, to really turning his life around to being both an amazing story and an amazing inspirational story as well. But this is going to be the second of three episodes I publish here on the Prius Spot Care podcast. My cadence is very different, so the release schedule is about once a month on Restore. Please do be aware that there's only going to be one more of these published on the Prius Spot Care podcast next month. And this is a really fascinating story of Mike's. I'll formally introduce it within the episode, but just to be aware and give you a trigger warning, Mike does speak candidly about self-harm and indeed drug use. Within a suicide attempt within the episode. So there'll only be one more episode of Restore published on the Prius Spot Care podcast next month, but please do enjoy this, and if you like the content, please do just search for Restore with Owen Walker and you'll find 77 episodes, I believe, over on Restore with myself. All right, do enjoy. Welcome to the Restore podcast with me, Owen Walker. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Mike Donnell. We're going to unpack his journey through growing up, dropping out of school, drug use, mental health, self-harm, suicide attempts, steroid use, sex, mental health, and all before 21 years old. So we're also going to look at Mike's journey beyond 21. We're going to look at his life through the gym, through alcohol, through relationships, tattoos, steroids, but also the 180 degree turn to cleaning everything up and indeed influencing others for the better, as well as his current revelations on health, faith, and a balanced mindset. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Mike, I just wondered if we could just start with, for listeners, just contextualize your home life, just growing up.
Well, my home life growing up would have been, I was constantly had this ball of energy, this bundle of energy of what can I get up to? What can I do next? What can I do? Who can I annoy? Who's going to chase me? You know, and you're talking from a very, 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 very early age. So, like toddler age, you know, like right up. So then obviously that led me into being a bit of a bad lad around the estate. Nothing too wild and crazy, you know. But then that obviously primary school, you know. So even through primary school, even I noticed it now more being older, you know, didn't notice it at the time, just how much energy that I had inside of me with zero direction. You know, the only direction it was going was chaos and mayhem. You know, that was the only way it was going, because it was who gonna annoy, who gonna wind up. I know what I'll do. I'll annoy the teacher to the point where she absolutely explodes, you know. So through primary school, you can imagine me having that sort of feeling of annoyance. And then as I've got older, again, I realised that, and now I feel sorry for the teacher, because how would you have dealt with me in class? You know, how would you have dealt with the what? Like, so to put it in like a scale, if for anybody watching, imagine the class clown and times him by 100. And that's what I was like in school. So my educational standpoint, you know, wasn't very, very good, because I was given through primary school whatever would have kept my attention, you know. And again, I felt sorry for the teachers, because they had another 30 children to deal with, you know. So I would have been given dot-dot-dots, colouring ins, really anything that kept my attention, you know, drawings, whatever it was. You know, and that was what my life was like kind of through primary school. And even then, in school in general, they may as well have spoken another language. You know, nothing they said held my attention.
And then
that wasn't just through school. That was out of school, you know, where I was getting chases. I was lighting wind bushes on fire and pinging stones at cars, just doing anything to just to cause an absolute disturbance, you know. But for me, it was fun and games, you know, because I was doing whatever I could that held my attention. And I think the only thing that held my attention was trying to grab everybody else's attention in a negative way.
Yeah.
You know, so that obviously would have been my primary school. So when it come up to doing your 11 plus running like that, the teachers had just advised that there was absolutely no point in me doing anything like that.
Yeah. So Mike, at that time, what was going on at home? Was there any applied discipline from your mother or father, or how did your home life look at that point?
See, this is the thing, you know, we would have been very disciplined. You know, by mother and father. You know, my father was ex-services, ex-army. He was stationed over here in the Troubles, met my mum, so on and so forth. So when we were at home, it was very strict, very regimented. If we wanted anything, we had to work for it. You know, Hoover, cleaning, dishes, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it wasn't like, you know, and even then, it just shows you, it just came to me now, you know, like I was still like that at home. And we would have got smacked and all, and it didn't faze me, you know. Like, don't get me wrong, I didn't enjoy it, you know, but I'm still doing it again 5 minutes later, you know. So as per parental upbringing, and you couldn't fault of them, you know. Yes, it was strict, but you know, clearly I needed it and didn't listen to it, you know what I mean? So you know, so and I'll highlight this now because obviously, we've covered kind of primary school age. Coming into my teens of high school age was when the drugs and drink use started because coming up into those years, that went, what would I do next? It turned into, what can I take next? What can I take? What can I do? What can I say? You know, to change, to do whatever I needed to do to change that feeling of no direction or going in all directions at the same time. So I sorry, as I was saying there, my parents didn't drink, didn't take drugs. Do you know what I mean? So and we were disciplined, and you know, so it wasn't like we were just, they were kind of haywire themselves. They drank, they took drugs. You know, we were, you know, if anything, they were role models, you know, for what you would look up to be. You know, didn't drink, didn't take drugs, hardworking. So on and so forth, you know, but I went the opposite direction. So it did. So that'll take me into 13, it was 13 or 14 when I started smoking dope. You know, my friends were smoking dope and I tried it. And even then, the second that I smoked, I think my friend made me, it was a waterfall or a bucket or something like that, that a water made the cannabis burn as it went down or something like that. So anyway, I did one of those things, and I was sitting in a room full of my mates. Nobody spoke a word, and inside of my head, it was going, "They're all talking about you. They're all laughing at you." So that was my first, and I remember it vividly. That was my first experience in taking drugs, and it still had that negative impact in my mind, but it didn't stop me taking them. So the few experiences that I had smoking dope, so I would say it would have been between the ages of 12. High school age 12 to 14, and then between the ages of 14 to 15 was when I went from dope for the few times I did try it to ecstasy. Now that was heavy drug use, you know. So from the ages of 14, 15 to 20, you know, and it got to the stage where I was taking ecstasy 10 at once just to get a hit, you know. Tennies at once just to get a
Yeah,
hit,
that's
you
crazy.
know.
Yeah.
That's exactly it, you know. So, but obviously, in that time frame, you know, and the problem is when you have that negative nagging sort of voice in your head of where am I going? What am I doing? What am I up to? Why are you doing that? You know. So that was constantly going on in my head. So the thing is, when you take drugs, that dampened down, and you just rolled about the floor like an idiot. You know, well, you were there taking 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10s at once. Do you know what I mean? But the thing was with my estate back then, there was a drug dealer in every other block, and I and somebody in my party group had a flat in between every other block. So we literally went from block to block, you know. So we would have started taking drugs on Friday and finished on Wednesday. So you're talking a lot of aids being taken, So if you could think of how quickly you would build up to taking the tolerance of taking tennies at once, if you're taking them Friday to Wednesday, or Tuesday at least, you know what I mean?
And also, Mike, and were you also drinking at this? Was alcohol sort of coming into the picture at this time?
Beforehand, I didn't really drink. No, I didn't drink much. I drank, I think, a handful of times. I had one sort of drunken bad experience, and that put me off. So what I did was had all the A's going, and didn't drink. You know what I mean? So where's the censor? Do you know what I mean? And didn't really drink. People are like, oh, you don't drink, you're doing well, as you've just swallowed five A's. Do you know what I mean? So obviously then a lot of mental health problems started, so the 14, 15, 16, 17, when you're taking all these uppers, and what goes up must come down. Now the thing is, when you have that kind of like, where am I going? What am I doing? And it wasn't always like, let's get up to mischief. On the other side of that coin, when you did do something wrong or bad, the brain kind of split into these, we'll say, two different sort of personalities, but the same personality. One's going, why do you keep doing these things? You shouldn't be doing them. You can't do it. And then the other side of you was arguing with it, going, well, why wouldn't I do it? What else will I do? I'll go and do something else, I obviously knew the difference between right and wrong and the right direction to take, but I always picked the wrong direction. I always did, So even though those early teen years to the late teen years, there's a lot of drug use, and then the calm downs. So as I was saying about that voice, that conversation, that talking in your head, it was magnified by 100 when you were coming off ease. And the thing was, as that built up, so I was taking ecstasy to escape those feelings, those thoughts, those, that kind of those self-destructive directions that I was headed in. And then on the come down, it was magnified by 20. And a minimum, it's hard to even explain how it was magnified. It was just constant. What are you doing? Where are you going? What are we doing? Where are we going? What are you doing? Where are you going? But there was like five different, it was the same, it was me talking to myself, but it was like five different conversations going on at once. So the thing was with that, the pressure built up and built up and built up and built up, so that if there wasn't access to drugs, that was self-harm, and I realized then that self-harm was a massive release of pressure. So, and then what I realized I was doing was I was swapping one pain for another. I was literally swapping pain. So the thing would have been, if I wasn't high on anything, they would have been superficial, like with a Bic razor or something like that, something that you couldn't really do a lot of damage with. If I was high, it was a Stanley knife. So it shows you the difference between, not that any of it would have been rational thinking, but the difference of not being on drugs and being on drugs, it was magnified, your actions were magnified, so obviously that then, you still drink, you're sorry, so then drink came into the picture late sort of teens, so that I wasn't taking drugs all the time, but then you just end up mixing the two of them. And then obviously the pressures of the mental health problems were magnified again after all that, so you're talking self-harming, suicide attempts, and you're literally talking the self-harming with Stanley knives, self-harming razor blades, until the day where it got too much, and I hung myself,
Gosh.
so I think it was 19 at the time. And I obviously I survived the suicide because I'm here to speak to you about it, but then it was successful because I hung myself. Whoever found me, I don't know. I literally woke up, so the hospital would be probably a 5 mile drive. Obviously, it'd be quicker than an ambulance and stuff like that, but I was resuscitated, fortunately, obviously. and woke up in the Royal, you know. So from my house to the Royal, you know, and in doing that, I realized that wasn't the answer because it was very, 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 very scary. I couldn't sleep for months after it. Whenever I closed my eyes to fall asleep, it was like stepping off that stool and hanging myself again because of that darkness, you
So
know.
I was gonna ask about that. That sounds like a seminal event, like a rock bottom event, Mike. You know, you just hit that rock bottom. You have a suicide attempt, which is almost semi-successful, to be honest. But so you come through that, and what replaces? So did you then sort of really stop drinking, stop drugs? Did the gym start coming in at that time? What did you replace some of these pain mechanisms with?
Well, we're coming into late teens, early 20s now. So after the suicide attempt, I was sectioned in Knockbracken, which is a mental health hospital in Belfast. I was sectioned in there for 4 to 5 months. So it was, but even being in there, you know, it wouldn't leave. You know, I was still self-harming. I mean, like, it was even a plastic spoon. You know, it was breaking the plastic spoon so that I could self-harm, you know. But I would never have tried to commit suicide again, you know, never. And I always believe to this day, you know, like I know a lot of friends that have passed because they continued the lifestyle and they've killed themselves, and it's been drink related, it's been drug related, you know, they've been high, they've been drunk, you know, and I just wish people like that could have the second chance that I had, because they would realize that there's no coming back from it. It is a massive mistake, like, you know, that you literally can't come back from. So we'll get back to so I was sectioned for 4 to 5 months in Knockbracken. But even then, coming out of Knockbracken, 21, 22, but then I started drinking. I mean, I'm not taking drugs no more. They're no good. So I was drinking, self-harming, taking drugs occasionally. So it was, and then that again for it was another 3, 4 years of doing that, you know. So you're talking 11, 12 years of hard drug use and drink, you know. So my mental health was just in the toilet, you know. And again, I was always at odds with myself because I knew the right path to go down, but I always chose the wrong one. I always went, well, sure, I'll just take two more E's, you know, I'll just have that one more pint and then I'll go home. But that one more pint's never one more pint. It's that one more pint is the one bad decision that leads you on to the next 10 pints, you know, and then the next 10 pints lead into taking drugs because you're starting to get tired. Everybody's still out partying, you know. So then what actually happened was, so my life was still pretty much the same, with drink, drugs, self-harming. But the suicide attempts obviously weren't there. So my dad asked me one time to come to the gym. So I was about 23, between 20, near 20 years, maybe 23. So I was about 23 at the time. My dad asked me to come to the gym. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I wouldn't know what to do. And he says, just come with me one day. And I went one day and I couldn't even scratch the back of my head. My chest was sore, my arms were sore, my butt was sore, my calves were sore, and I was like, wow, that's great, you know, look at how much pain I'm in, you know. So then I went one day a week for about a month or so, or for about a month we'll say, but still out doing the other things 5 days out of the week. Then it was like, oh, I'll train another day. So we're training 2 days out of the week, you know, still doing the other. And it was like, oh, I'll train 3 days a week. And then I learned that I would never self-harm over my tattoos. Okay. And because the tattoos represented scar tissue to me then. I was like, that area is marked, that area is damaged, that's mine now. And obviously then with the gym, you're constantly in pain. You know, you're constantly in pain. So what I did there then was I turned my basically addictive personality into two other areas that were still covering the same things that I needed covered, but on the outside, there was a different outcome. You know, there's just you're jacked and covered in tattoos, not scars. So yes, so then I started doing that. So I'm now I'm now 40, and it's took me like 17 years to be completely tattooed from head to toe. And I'm in reasonable shape. But sorry, so then I trained for a couple of years naturally, about 6, 7, 8 years naturally, because that was my fix, and it was like I was training twice a day. I was running to the gym. I just found another avenue to vent. The frustration of what direction are you going in? What that self-destructive pattern was then, and turned internally, and I was self-destructing myself, but externally no one knew a thing. Everyone just seen this guy covered in tattoos, bubbling with confidence. But didn't care. Genuinely didn't care. So a couple of years, was going well, and then it turned out that wasn't enough. My friends that I was training with said, "Oh, you should try some of this." It was anabolic steroids. So I started with D-ball, and again, the same, one a day turns into 5 a day, 5 a day turns into 3 a day, and 2 mil a week, 2 mil a week turns into 6 mil a week, and 50 milligram of Anavar a day. So the thing was, the problem is with doing all that on the exterior, you look great. The byproduct of self-destruction in the gym environment is externally, it looks good. But internally I was at war. I was still at war with myself. I was still, all I wanted to do was destroy myself. When I walked into the gym, I would have looked at myself and I went, "I'm gonna flip and ruin you," but I would have said a swear word. I don't swear as much as I used to now. And that's how I was. It was just destruction, self-destruction, self-destruction, self-destruction. And that's so that again, this takes me up into my 30s, so 30, and then I met, so as per, I mean, coming across now, and I didn't realize this at the time, but when you're very selfish, when you're very self-destructive, when you're, anything, like any relationships that I'd have been in, if they'd have said anything to me that I didn't like, I was away. I was gone. It wasn't even an argument. It wasn't even a discussion. I just left and didn't care, So obviously, in the time frame that I spoke about, the amount of relationships started and ended, and it was all obviously, I was clearly no saint, like, but at the time I didn't think there was anything wrong. At the time I was going, "I'm God's gift. These women should be lucky to have me because I wasn't a horrible person." But what I didn't realize was all my actions weren't good. There wasn't one thing done in a positive light. It was all for self-hatred. It was all for self-destruction. So everything that I did had this toxicity about it that was just pure toxic. And it was pure toxic because it was all for selfish reasons. So that took me up into my 30s, and then I met my partner now, Dion. And like I've said, like, how, I don't know, like, we're together 9 years, and how she stuck me for the past eight is absolutely beyond me.
But it sounds,
Because
Mike, like she's really, she was one of these circuit breakers, really, and a real blessing to you that she kind of really not only just would forgive, but would keep continually kind of almost just counterbalance you, bring you down, and bring and start to, because in other interviews I've heard you speak about, just you'd start to question. Why is she loving? Why does she love me? Why is she continually reaching towards me? And so it was, yeah, could you speak to that and that kind of revelation?
yeah, well, I mean, like, as per where Dion's concerned, again, I only now realizing, walking with the Lord a year, how selfish, self-destructive, and toxic that I was. Because I knew inside of me that I loved Dion with all my heart. Like, I met Dion when I was in 3rd year at school, and I always fancied her in school, so it was like my dream girl. So imagine in your early 30s, you're now starting to go out with the girl that you fancied for the past 25 years. Do you know what I mean? So, and Dion just has such a beautiful heart, like, you know, she really, 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 really does, you know. And how she's, I honestly feel, and I say this with, you know, how she put up with me treating her like, with me being an absolute scumbag is ridiculous. But sorry, I'll get on to what I was saying there. So, I mean, like, everything that I did, I knew was wrong, but I couldn't change it. And I knew one thing, that I loved her with all my heart, you know, and I wanted and tried to be the best man that I could be for her, you know, and then also for my children as well. But what I realized was, if you're selfish, you're putting, and you should know this, but it took me 40 years to figure it, that then the Lord had to show me it, so he did. But you know, how could I tell Dion that I loved her and wanted to be everything that she could possibly be when you're out taking drugs and steroids and the gym comes before everything? Do you know what I mean? And it's the same with my children and all, you know. But like I was saying, that Dion just has this, she just has this light about her, you know. She really, really, really does, like, you know, her heart's always open. And she must have seen a glimpse of the man that I could have been, you know, because I always aimed to try to be the man that I am now, but I just couldn't get there. And then I realized I couldn't get there because of the never-ending stream of selfish, toxic, bad decisions that I consistently made, you know.
Yeah,
And
absolutely. Yeah.
you know, and again, it's like, you know, I want to be the best partner to Dion, but as soon as Dion spoke, I'm away on the drink. You know, and would have been something silly, you know, like, "Do you like my shoes?" "Yeah." "You know, fourth time, what do you think of my shoes?" "I've told you four times now, I'm away." You know, it's, and that's how silly it would have been, you know. But because, sorry, so I've missed out in a bit there. So, but because I was either hungover on a calm down, or I was juiced up on steroids. See, the thing is with steroids, you know, and I'm not sure if everybody's took drugs or they've drank. So drugs, you know, your head's amplified. For me to describe it, the voices are like warm, 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 you know, in and out, in and out, in and out. Steroids magnify whatever way you think and the person you are by five. So if you're prone to talking inside your head, if you're a selfish person, it amplifies that by five.
By
It really,
five.
really does. Like, so
Yeah.
yes, it might amplify the exterior by five. And again, something so horrible can look so good. Internally, the opposite. So it is, you know.
So yeah, absolutely, Mike, and like you said, it's kind of you're swapping one drug for another, and also like you said, just there's no baseline of consistency in mental health, because it's you either up, down, or you're this amplified kind of situation with the steroids. And so could you speak to what happens as far as, because kids start to come along, and does there start to become some sense of sort of stability and kind of baseline of normality with kids, or is it still quite chaotic, or how is it working out?
Well, with the kids coming along, again, what I tried to be was the man that I am now. But the problem is when your actions conflict with what you're trying to be in your mind. So basically, your bad decisions, you're still at that kind of conflict in your mind, you know. And my like, as every father, you know, or most dads, you know, want to be a role model to your children. You know, there's no ifs, buts, or maybes about it. You know, I look at my dad and go, "Now, you know," and I'm like, I want to be that. You know, I want to be a reflection of my father for my daughter to look up to and go, "That's how a man treated my mommy. That's how I should be treated." And my son to go, "This is how my dad acts as a man. This is how he treats my mother. You know, this is how he's treated us growing up." I want to admit that, you know. But again, what they didn't know was, you know, when your actions, so yes, I took them everywhere. So yes, I took them to the park, you know, but you're taking them to the park and you're hungover. you're taking to the park and you've took drugs. You're taking to the park and you're jacked up on steroids and you have zero patience. Do you know what I mean? So again, externally, people are seeing you out and about with your kids all the time, but the kids are actually dealing with the actions that you've decided to take, you know, of having no patience. So again, there's another thing with steroids. You have no patience. I don't care. Anybody that takes steroids says they're fine on them. They're lying. They're lying. They're not.
It's just absolutely, like you said, it kind of not only accentuates the probably their feelings of selfishness, but also, like you said, it kind of it absolutely messes with your internal sort of narrative, your internal self-talk. And So as things are progressing, Mike, like you said, there's this kind of relationship with pain, which is quite destructive, and actually, like you said, there's this really focus on swapping one pain for another pain, but it's all quite painful. As you're coming along, so you've got Amber and Ezra, your children, which are starting to sort of grow up, and you're kind of start stewarding their lives as a father. What was the precursor to one of the most seminal moments in your life, this kind of fundamental change? What started to happen, or indeed what was Amber talking about?
What had happened was, and this was actually shown to me in prayer, was, and this is why I kept using the word toxicity and toxic, is because when your mind is at war with itself, you know, and even if you're putting a brave face on, you know, and you're going, yes, okay, that toxicity oozes out of your pores. It's like if you walk into a house and two people have been arguing, but you didn't hear them arguing, you feel that. You know, you feel that tension in the air. So that's what I know now that that emitted off me. Now it didn't emit off me out in the streets because everyone would have went, oh, he's a lovely guy. Because I stopped and spoke to absolutely everybody. But when I came home, like, don't get me wrong, I wasn't coming home and banging and slamming, but the mask came off, the smile went away. You know, the internal thoughts of going, why do you do this? Why do you torture yourself? You know, why this, why that? So Amber's like her mum, big heart, big heart, very, very sensitive to as well to other people's feelings. So Amber always asked me, Daddy, are you okay? From a young age, you know, from 3 and 4, you know, Daddy, are you okay? Always asked me, you know, like, and I'd be walking through the living room, Daddy, are you okay? You know, and I'm like, yes, darling, I'm fine. And then, you know, like you're talking a couple of times out of the day. So then what happened was Amber turned around to me and says, Daddy, could we go to church? And I went, I got a mouthful of tea or something. What? What? I'm a Viking. I don't go to church. People from church run away from me. I'm a Viking. You know, and so I says, no, Amber, love, your mommy will take you to church. She'd love to take you to church. No, Daddy, I want you to take me to church. I was like, right, Amber, no, I'm not going to church. And then so obviously she says, ah, your Granny Pat, she loves her Granny Pat. Her Granny Pat is her favorite. Like, Granny Pat will take you to church. Ask Granny Pat, she'll definitely take you. No, Daddy, I want you to take me. So the Lord knew, he knew no matter what, I would do anything for my children. Whatever they want to do, go to Funky Monkeys dressed as furries or Ninja Turtles out in the street, I would do it. Do you know what I mean? So upon her, I think it took her about a month, so I decided to go to church. And I even before walking through the church doors, I was like, I'm gonna catch fire. I'm gonna disintegrate in the dust. You know, I'm a Viking. I don't go to church. You know, so even as soon as I walked into church, a lady Linda came up to say hello, and I literally put my hand out and says, "Don't speak to me. I'm just gonna sit up the back. I'm here for my daughter." You know, I didn't nothing, 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 nothing. She wasn't as blunt as that now, but it was basically like that. So, like, I'm 6'2", 16 and a half stone. Linda's like 4 foot. She's probably not. She's 5 foot. And I literally went, no, I'm gonna sit at the back. I'm here for my daughter. That's it. So again, yeah. So it was my first experience in church. And as the weeks went on, I was sitting there going, I added it all up, and I went, I've lost like 12 hours of my life. I've literally, how am I getting these 12 hours back? you know, Amber, you better be grateful for this, so to speak, you know. And then as I was sitting there and I was listening and I was playing with my phone and, you know, half listening, and then German minister said, "Christ is for everyone, you know, or the faith is for everyone." It was something along those lines, and my ears just picked up, and I looked up and went, "Did he mean me?" You know, and I was like, "Well, maybe he did. Is Jesus for everyone?" You know, so then and going and all the while, he, and it just shows you, you know, he was at work anyway, because I drank every night. I drank every single night, 3, 4 beers, and it was purely I said it was the de-stress, but it was the runaway. Do you know what I mean? And I got drunk twice a week. I got drunk every Thursday night, and I got drunk every Saturday night. And you're not t so you're talking 18 and 18 boxes of beer and a bottle of rum a week. That was normal. That was normal.
That's
That's how much.
intense, Mike. That's intense. I mean, I would not be standing after 18 bottles of beer and a bottle of rum.
You
Golly.
know, so well, that's how much I drank a week. So 30, what's 18, 18, 36. So 36 cans of beer a week and a bottle of rum.
It's becoming.
And 2 liters of Coke Zero mixed with the rum. Do you know what I mean? So even in attending church, and I smoked, and I was still occasionally taking drugs, and I was taking steroids. So what happened was, as I was attending the church that month, you know, I got friendly with some of the lads. Some of the lads were interested in training, and I always trained by myself, because my fuel was hatred. You know, I always trained by myself. I was like, look at that mirror, pick something you don't like and destroy it. Hate what you see in the mirror. Hate is your fuel. So as I was attending for the month, you know, I went and started training with some of the lads from church. I went, "Do I need to drink every night?" You know, "No, I don't." So the beers went every night. Still drank on a Thursday and a Saturday. Then I went, "Do I need to drink on a Thursday?" I don't like, so I start drinking on a Thursday. Then I was like, "Let none of these lads smoke either. So I'll stop smoking." Then I went, "Nobody swears. Like, we're all training together, and like the gym environment is like F blinding, you know, move your butt, you know." And I went, "Nobody swears. Like, they're doing sets and going, oh, flip, that was tough, you know." And I'm spitting on the floor all rah. You know, so then the swearing. So, you know, like even at the time, you know, all these lads, you know, all these strong Christian men are just admitting these reflections of Jesus to me that I didn't even know. So even when it came up to 3 months of attending church and I was invited to Alpha, I didn't realize at the time, you know, I just thought that I was just doing well. You know, the Lord was at work there, just chipping things away. So then I was invited to Alpha. And then week three of Alpha, the Lord came into my life with a great big bang. So he did.
Yeah, so at the time, your wife is seeing this fundamental change, you know, but slowly but surely, it's chip, like you said, it's chipping away initially, and things are starting to fall off you, the drink, the drugs, the swearing. So what was this week three encounter? What just describe it to us.
So week three, I think it was reading the Bible or something along those lines. If it wasn't week three, it was week four. And I just, and obviously with my education, you know, as I've spoken about my primary school, as you can tell by my teens where I was speaking, I got through to school at the end of 3rd year, start of 4th year. So my education was non-existent. Also my attention, I had the attention span of a fish. You know, I literally had the very, very, unless I was really, really into it, it did not hold my attention. So week three was reading the Bible, and I was like, "How do you read the Bible? You know, like how do you read the Bible? Like, you know." So I went, well, I waste about 2 hours in the morning, because I just show I get up at three, half three in the morning. So I do just to start my day, then do absolutely nothing. So it was Monday morning. I read my Bible. And I think I was hungover. I think I'd been out or something on Saturday or something. And because I was feeling really down, I was feeling really low, and after reading my Bible, I just put my hands out, both hands out like this, and I says, "Jesus, please come into my life. I need you in my life." I says, "Please, please, please come in." And within an instant, I mean, within a millisecond, and it wasn't even a millisecond, it was just instant. It was just like, boom, I have always been there. But didn't say those words, but took me to pictures. And at the time, I didn't know it was a picture. I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it. It was goosebumps from head to toe. It was your stomach turning inside out. It was like a bang, but there was no noise. And he took me to two pictures of passing and qualifying my level two fitness instructor and level 3 personal training. And in that instant, he'd said, I'd always been there, but he didn't say those words. It was all feeling and through picture. I've always been there, and then like from that moment on, my life has completely changed. From I will actually say, from that moment on, that man that was fueled by hate, that toxic, borderline alcoholic, died.
I mean, that's powerful, Mike. That's powerful. And that's, like you said, up until that moment, it had been incremental. But at that time, it was almost like a knife came, the surgical knife came down and changed. So Mike, just, just looking at the back at the last sort of few months, 6 months to a year, just as we're starting to come into land, just explain to me and to listeners what you've kind of started to see in the community, because me and you were put in touch through my brother, who has done a lot of prison ministry and prison pastor work. But just explain to listeners what you've started to see.
Well, what I've started to see, it's really love, it's literally the word love. Love everybody. And it's not only love everybody, it's show everybody Jesus. Everybody needs to see Jesus, and this is exactly why he wants to use me to tell everybody about him. So like I said, when that guy that was literally fueled by hatred fueled me. If I wasn't in pain, I was depressed. Do you know what I mean? If I wasn't physically in pain, I was depressed. So whether that was being hungover or on a come down or in pain from training, I was always in some sort of element of pain, if not all of it, that guy that was fueled and wanted it, basically his addiction was pain, died. He died, because that want, that desire, that emptiness, that chasing everything else other than following in the Lord's footsteps. Do you know what I mean? And
I
it shows
do,
you,
yeah.
yeah, it shows you as well, because the past 39 years of my life without Christ has been a disaster. Without having somebody to follow, it's been a disaster. I actually explained it as a car crash, because it was shown to me in prayer as I look behind myself of the previous 39 years. It is literally, there's a trail of devastation in my wake. So there is, and that was because I was selfish, I was arrogant, I was on drugs, I was drinking, I was taking steroids, and on top of all that, I thought I was a good person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I
Mike,
was a good
totally.
person. You know
Yeah.
why I was a good person? Does that sound like a good person? Doesn't, does it? But I thought I was a good person because I was nice to everybody.
Yeah.
So my walk with the Lord now, honestly, I just have this over about a pa passion for Christ. All need to know him. All need him in their lives. There's no ifs, buts, or maybes about it. Lost, broken, unsatisfied, yet you have everything you want. There's something missing. It's him. He is missing.
So, Mike, just give listeners and indeed me an idea of who has really come into your path, because I think you've seen some fantastic and just really people you wouldn't think of actually just come full circle, come 180 and come to faith. Could you give me an idea of who you've sort of spoken to and who indeed has started to come to faith?
Well, in my walk, and people that I've spoken to, and I've invited three men to Alpha that have accepted the Lord. There's a paramilitary leader in the estate that I had a conversation with, and he's accepted the Lord. So the seed was definitely sown with him, and we had a very good conversation in his front garden about the way of sin, you know. And you know, and it also shows. So there's that's just four men, you know, that have seen a reflection, you know, and three that I know of, you know, that have accepted the Lord, you know, because they've seen whatever he's admitted through me, you know.
Absolutely, Mike. I mean, this is from a guy which, like you said, I mean, so you just admitted there, you know, and just walked us through drug use, mental health, self-harm, suicide attempts, steroid use, sex, mental health sectioning, alcohol, you know, tattoos, just so just looking at your life now alone speaks volumes to what's happened in your heart and mind
No, that's it.
Through coming to faith.
You know? And that's exactly why the Lord is using me the way that he is, because of how I look. And I didn't realize at the time, because to be fair, this past year, well, not the whole year, I've done nothing but argue with him. Why me? Why do you want to use me? And it was purely because of my lack of education in his word, even in understanding of the Christian faith, because there's been no religion in my life whatsoever. Do you know what I mean? Prior, and I mean, when I say religion, I mean like knowledge. You know, my parents weren't religious. I knew nothing off the Bible. I never attended Sunday school. I never went to BB. Obviously, as you know by my schooling, RE was over my head if they let me in. Do you know what I mean? Because even my high school years, if I wasn't suspended, I was on the beak. If it wasn't on the beak, it was out of class. So the 3 years that I attended high school, it was probably rounded up to like 2 months.
Yeah, no, Mike, totally. Totally, totally, totally. And I think that's the beautiful thing, isn't it? That actually, you know, there is no one beyond there's no one beyond the pale. And like you heard it, like subconsciously, whilst you were texting on your phone at the back of the church at that time. But
exactly.
Even that went in and you know and resounded with you, which is fantastic, really. And to see your passion as well, and to see, like you said, it actions speak louder than words, and just to see your complete 180 is powerful, to the point where, you know, my brother was saying to me, Owen, you have to interview this guy. He is an absolute legend. And so just as we come into sort of final thoughts, Mike, and take our messages, could you maybe just speak to that very point about if anyone else feels as hopeless as you did, or as indeed as lost as you did, or just substituting whatever for just using pain in different ways, could you maybe speak to your testimony as to reach out to them?
Well, here's a prime example from asking the Lord into my life. I don't drink, I don't take steroids, and this past year I've took drugs once. And that was because I was overconfident. I put myself in this situation where I actually went and I said, I'm going to go and tell everybody about Jesus. And I failed. So I did. But, you know, like I was, sorry, as I was saying there, I mean, the guys, no matter what way you're feeling, there is nothing that is going to compare. Like your drug head, you know, and I'll tell you this, and if anybody's listening that took drugs, when have you ever got up the next day, 2 days, 3 days later from taking drugs and went, that was a great night? Never, never, because you're busted. Internally, your head's gone. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And yeah. What we need is Jesus. That's all we need. All we need in our lives is Jesus. And you and him work out the rest and following him. You know, and it's very, very simple. Once you start following in him, he will reflect and he will show you exactly where you're going wrong. And that is because, like I said, I thought I was a good person. I thought I didn't need Jesus. Do you know why? Because I was nice to people out in the street. But what I didn't realize, so let's say out of 10 things, being nice to people in the streets, one, I was doing all the other 9 things were all in the wrong direction and all took me away further and further and further away from Jesus. And yet the second I asked him to come into my life and truly meant it, he was there for me in an instant and told me and showed me that he's always been there. So there's no drugs that are going to fulfill your heart. There's no the amount of money that's going to fulfill your heart. There's no cars that's going to fill your heart. There's no stuff that's going to fill your heart. Jesus will fill your heart. And he will guide you if you all you do is open your heart and ask him to come in and follow in him. It's that simple.
Yeah, Mike, listen, that's profound. That's profound. And you're a living, walking testimony, Mike, to that statement. And you know, your life shows how you've just had this 180, complete 180 turn, and which is powerful in and of itself. Yeah, and
it even shows you even through, like, I know obviously from an educational standpoint, my passion for learning of the Lord's living word only equals my passion for telling people about him. Do you know what I mean? Like, I read every day, I pray every day, you know, I'm going to Bible study days here, there, and everywhere. And of course, I'm 5 weeks out from finishing my evangelism course with your brother, you know.
Yeah, it's fantastic. That's amazing. Yeah, listen, Mike.
And now I'm toying with the idea of going to Bible college.
Yeah, it's powerful, Mike. It's powerful. It's powerful. And actually, like you said, what it does is it reaches, just your testimony alone reaches out to people that feel like they are beyond the pale, but they've gone too far. They're beyond redemption, or indeed beyond, you know, help. Or, you know, if people just seeing the way you've turned it around and actually just affected change for the better in your own life and other people's lives is a massive testimony, Mike, and just shows just that, you know, if you can do it, anyone can do it, which is super powerful, super mm-hmm. powerful.
But listen, I didn't do it alone.
You didn't, yeah, exactly. It was by God's grace, grace.
That's exactly it. Because like I said, the previous 39 years, that trail of devastation, that was me on my own.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was me at the helm. Yeah. Now the Lord's at the helm and I follow in him.
Yeah, powerful, Mike, powerful. Listen, what we'll do is in the show notes, we'll put just links to the church that you're involved with and some of the work you're involved with, which is also powerful. And if anyone wants to reach out to you, they can reach out to you through that link. But I just want to say thank you for being just so inspiring, but also just a living testimony, because even when the more I've dug into listening to you, because I've done a bit of research on you, watched a few different interviews, and I actually always come away just feeling just like really encouraged. So it's been powerful just to be almost be vicariously part of that journey in the background, Mike. So thank you.
Thank you.